Welcome to Hadar's Web, a podcast featuring community conversations on spirituality, healing, justice, and art. My name is Hadar Cohen. I am your host, and I am delighted to invite you to my relational web. Today's guest is Daniel Four. Daniel is a doctor of psychology, experienced ritualist, and the author of Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. He's an initiate in the Orisha tradition of Yoruba-speaking West Africa and practicing Muslim who has learned from the older ways of his English and German ancestors. Daniel is passionate about work at the intersection of cultural healing, animist ethics, and applied ritual arts. He lives with his wife and two daughters, ages 6 and 3, near Granada, Spain. For more on his work in the world, see ancestralmedicine.org. Welcome, Daniel. So happy to have you on my podcast.
Thanks so much, Hadar, and thanks for the invitation. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start off by just acknowledging when we first arrived to this Zoom room, you named that there is a lot of grief and that you wanted to just take a moment for the grief. So I wanted to just ask you a bit about the grief that lives inside of you. You know, I think it's so important, especially in this time, but not just, you know, part of our collective healing is really acknowledging and bearing witness and presencing the grief. So I was wondering if you could chat a little bit more about your grief in this moment.
Yeah, that's an opening. Let me just, by habit, situate myself slightly. Maybe my bio already did, but it feels important to name that my own people ancestrally are early settler colonialist in North America. And that's the cultural, you know, matrix where I was born and raised. So I'm like an American white guy. And I've been living here in Spain and the traditional lands of all kinds of people for the last year and a half. So it's an adoptive home here. But my personal grief, I mean there's personal layers of just the sorrow of things have been difficult in my own life. But beyond that, insofar as I've worked through anything psychologically to be just a functioning adult, it opens pathways to collective sorrow. And so the big sorrow that motivates everything I do in the world professionally is our perceived disconnection from the earth and the rest of life, that human supremacy, we can name it intellectually, but it's the my devotion with the earth and my sorrow about how we are catalyzing a massive extinction crisis because of our choices, and how there's not environmental problems, there's just bad human choices that come out of this place of supremacy. And it, over the years, as I've relearned, I know I'm giving a sort of intellectual answer, so bear with me. I'm not actually grief phobic, but I want to give some context. As I've learned over the years and been in a process ongoing, really, of reclaiming an animist or relational ethic that validates the personhood or the sentience, the reality of the other than humans, it's like my understanding of culture isn't human only. And so the genocide of like that's happening within different human communities, which is horrific, it's not only that, it's also all the many nations, communities, you know, tribes, ancestral groups, whatever, you speak of them in different ways, but like these people, these other people whose songs are disappearing from the planet because of how much absorption and like self-absorption in space we're taking up. So that's a sorrow that's with me. I can't even really approach it with the girls. Like, I'm parenting every day, of course, because I'm a dad. And it's hard to even talk about with them because it's such this like massive catastrophe that they're born into. And trying to titrate it a bit and not just be the doomed dad who's like, the world, it's heavy. And beyond that, I've come over the years to have a specialization in working with the dead, with ancestral healing. And so that has additionally meant that, in addition to all the living human pain that is really evident, and I got oriented to more training as a therapist and psychology person. In addition to that, there's all this unacknowledged pain among the dead and the sorrow of the ghosts of the ones who are forgotten, the ones who aren't grieved well, the ones who are die in unjust ways, and who die in a state of confusion, who weren't loved well to begin with. And a lot of those ones continue to suffer. And so a lot of the ritual work that I guide is about how to safely assist them. But even then, it's very regulated in terms of when we open to the big grief, because there's so much of it, because it's such this deep well. So I feel in my own life, like I kind of skate that edge of trying to participate in metabolizing the sorrow. I know how to not add to it. I know how to participate in changing our systems so we stop creating fresh pain and trauma. But the moments where it comes through, where I actually allow that to flow through my life, they're a little unpredictable. Sometimes I'll be talking with the kids. Sometimes, like, there was a month or so into the current genocide in Palestine before I had a good cry about it. And it wasn't until I went to a protest that I had a good cry. Because I guess I felt safe enough there. I'm like, oh, okay, I don't have to hold it. I don't have to hold this, like, but this is happening energy, because everyone around me is sharing in that moment. So then I just felt it more, what's actually happening. And that's fine. Like, I don't push it away when it comes. But those are some of the layers of it. It's a big earth sorrow. And, I've a sadness for the olives, for the poisoning of the waters, and for the effect of the bombing and the desert foxes. I mean, it's not only the humans, it's also the humans. But, and being a dad, like, how can I not feel the impact on the children more acutely because of that? So yeah, and we're just making such a generational backlog of new pain.
Yeah.
So there's a way in which I feel there's a sense of discouragement. I'm like, man, there's so many other better options than this. Like, and we're at such an urgent time. And at a historical crossroads, there was, I think it was in Doha, the climate summit. And it was the conversation was dominated by what's happening in Gaza, appropriately so, understandably so. But it means that the nations there didn't really get to this secondary topic of climate change. And so, it's different kinds of ancestral supremacies and colonialism and all that getting in the way of the other urgent demands of the times. So I don't know. That's a little bit about the sorrow. It kind of it motivates me to a large degree. It's a function of love. I mean, I love being here. I love the earth and the many beings, and it's hard what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I resonate with so much. And, I think especially this time is really a time of so much destruction that is really showing us how we in our human minds have been very conditioned to destroy, right? Not to pay attention to what is this sacred life force and how do we tend it. But just so much destructive patterns. And, one thing you spoke about is this connection between the body and the land and what happens when it's ruptured, which is a big part of my work. Part of colonization is right, really ripping people from their relationship and context to the land. And land is very much, our greatest source of support energetically, somatically. You know, it's what our body is made out of. So it's not just a physical rupture, right? It's a spiritual, energetic, ancestral of all these different realms. So yeah, I was curious if you, I know that you developed this very profound modality called ancestral medicine around how to also understand the body, not just as a personal body, right? But the body that also carries the ancestral dimension in it. And I'm curious if you could speak a little bit to that modality and how you see through your work and through your lens, like how this ancestral view influences, right, all these conversations about body, land, colonization, genocide.
Yeah, that's a big, good bundle of questions. Let me just wade into it and see what happens. It's true. I'm the founder. I've received, I guess, is how it feels to me, the gift of a particular set of practices I call ancestral lineage healing, and having. That arises from my own work of reclaiming relationships with blood lineage ancestors, which I wasn't oriented to at all as a young person. In the late 90s, that started to happen for me with some teachers at the time. And then maybe 5, 6 years later, after doing that work at depth and doing my therapy around it, started to help a few other people with it. And then over the last 25, whatever it is, 20 years, I wrote a book on that. I've started to train other people on how to guide it. So, guided some thousands of folks through a process of coming back into direct relationship with much older, like before remembered names, big wise ancestral elders or teachers in their lineages, partnering with them, listening to them, inviting their guidance to bring healing to those among the lineage who are not yet in peace. So that one's lineage, all the way from the elders through to the recent ones, can be in a healed state, in a settled, at peace state. They can be ancestors rather than ghosts. And in conceptually, it's not that complicated, really. But it's a way of saying we all have, call them what you will, like bodhisattvas or Auliyat, or maybe it would be Tzaddikim, or I don't know, like awake folks in our lineages that we can contact, whether or not they religiously fit the pattern of this or that tradition. And it's good to value that awakening spirit within our own lineage, because then we can know it in our own body, in our own face, especially when there's been impact in our experience of ourselves personally or culturally because of different kinds of supremacies. Either we have a low self-opinion or a high self-opinion, whatever it is that there's a, we want to be able to see what is really beautiful about humanity in our own body and lineage, with humility, of course. And that the ancestors can also help us to remember our specific gifts in the world, which is a kind of useful trap to have us embody more responsibility. Because as soon as you're like, oh, I have shiny spiritual gifts from my lineages, great, I'll pick them up. And then, they come with responsibility. They have to play out in ways that aren't always comfortable, right? In terms of how that plays out culturally, there's a lot that could be said about it. But I would say that as a American white guy, it's my observation, at least from my own background, that extreme individualism is poison. It's culturally toxic. And I'm still just starting to detox from the United States. Like, we're planning to visit this summer, and I'm like anxious about returning. And I find that spiritually speaking, the more that one believes that they're an individual in an isolated kind of way, the more the holies or the powers kind of recoil or like draw back. And they're like, oh, this is not a safe person. And the more susceptible we are to possession by harmful kinds of energies and powers that we don't really understand that well, because we're not drawing consciously on a kind of sustainable power that comes from relationships and community and from land connection. So working with the ancestors in a lineage-based way remains dynamic and interesting to me over the years because I see that it interrupts extreme individualism and helps people to kind of organically step into a little more responsibility or healthy accountability to be themselves, to be of service somehow. And in that way, when people start to identify more as a we or me and my people or us, or this is what I need to be doing because I inherit ancestral debts and I need to work at resolving those, when people have that mindset, they're safer to be around. They will tend to see others in a more lineage way. I guess me and my people having a conversation with you and your people. There's more etiquette. There's more like the shy spirits of the plants and the mountains will come out to play more because they recognize that this person is embedded in a larger network of relationships. So it's good spiritually, so to speak, in that way as well. It has implications in the unseen. But culturally, it's good because it's helps people to be more normal sized or regular sized, not too big, not too small. And a lot of the stuff that I do and have seen as a therapist, I also work as a therapist, but the psychological ways that people suffer, a lot of that's ancestral. It's lineage stuff. And it should be named and worked with on that level. It's more effective. Yeah.
I really love what you said of almost redefining safety, right? You're talking about someone who's safe is actually someone who is on some level healed or healed ancestrally or has, right, this inner space to receive someone else. And I think that that's such a beautiful understanding of safety because so often we think of safety in terms of the material world, right? Like, oh, do you have safe housing or, all this relationship to safety? But, I think safety can also be so much about the emotional and the spiritual, right? Like, how
It's a
are we?
funny, it's a funny metaphor, really, but people will get it. If you encounter someone that you don't know personally, but you see on social media that they're friends with like 30 of your most trusted people, you're likely to be like, oh, this person's probably not crazy, you know? It's a conferred trust because they're embedded in a relational network. Theoretically, they may or may not be a safe person, but like, I think the same thing happens on the unseen. It happens on the spirit level. It happens in all kinds of ways. Like, if I want to get to know the ancestors of this land, the old, like, Iberian pre-Roman tribal peoples of Andalusia, I could do worse than getting to know the olives and the foxes and the Urraca and the mountains and the Rio Genil and all the local powers and really love them and respect them. Because then we have people in common. Yeah.
That view of relational web as a form of safety is really powerful. I'm
Yeah.
curious, this word healing can mean all sorts of different things, and people use it in all sorts of ways these days. When we're talking about healing ancestors, what does that mean? Like, how do you know if an ancestor is healed? What makes it like a healed ancestor versus, you're seeing a ghost ancestor? Can you talk a little
Yeah,
bit more about that?
sure. The first thing that often comes up with the word healing is people, it can snag as being presumptuous because it's like, who are you to heal or something like that? And I don't necessarily see myself as a healer. I'm more of like an engineer or something, or like a technician. I don't know. But I feel like I'm the internet repair guy or something. Like, meaning that it's just about facilitating a reconnection with the powers that do have the healing. And so in this case, it's the older ancestors who bring that. But so where do they draw their power from? Well, directly from source, from the earth, the waters. Where does the earth draw its power from? Then you get into mystical, a law, mystery, source, how you want to frame that is kind of a personal choice, but source energy. And but that it flow through the form of lineage matters. So the work is helping that flow to be restored through the lineage. where it ideally would already be there, but because of generations of trauma, dislocation from land, breakdown of relationships between the living and the dead, because those relationships have been stigmatized, whatever it is. So then there's a backlog, often a generational backlog. But so the first thing is that the healing comes from the elder powers. In terms of a second thing is that there's no judgment around the one suffering. It's not like an ableist paradigm where it's like, oh, you're unhealed, you need to get healed, and that needs to look a certain way. No. But there is a difference between someone who is tormented and confused and suffering and believes themselves to be cut off from source and so is enacting wickedness in the world, compared to someone who is relationally tapped in. They are nurturing, they're kind. You would feel safe with them around the kids. Like they have a benevolence to them. They're just different. There is a kind of quality of energy thing there. But healed can look like really bold, dynamic warriorship. It can look like really edgy, lunar poetry and mysticism. It can look like so many different forms, many different like faces of the divine, as it were. So there's that. But a much more pragmatic answer is you connect with the really wise elder powers and you ask them, like, is this lineage is in a healed state? The first step in the actual methodology is to carefully guide people through assessing four different blood lineages and wonder, does it feel really healed and safe? Would you be okay with them appearing in your room at night to give you a blessing? Or would you be like, oh, hell no, that is not safe at all? Like most people know the difference when tuning in with their own ancestors. So there is a piece in the method or the practice of the thing about affirming and trusting our ability to know intuitively most of the time. It's just a capacity we have. But we ask the trusted powers and kind of sit with it and wonder about it. But beyond that, a lot of the epistemology, the particular way of knowing, is a direct intuitive practice. Yeah.
Yeah. So as a follow-up, I'm curious, because when someone in your lineage dies, right, there's a spiritual process, whatever tradition you believe in, right? But there's all sorts of processes that the soul goes through to kind of reunite with the God consciousness, with the spirit, with the divine.
Yeah.
And, you were speaking earlier about what happens when someone dies in a way that is very gruesome or unjust, and the way that that's kind of imprinted on the lineage. But yeah, I guess I'm curious, because there's some level where it's like that's an organic spiritual process that the soul goes through, right, through death and through reunification with the wider divine fields. But then there's ways in which we as humans can also tend to
That's
support
right.
that process. So,
Yeah.
yeah, I'm curious about your take about those two. And
I mean, the sun will swallow the earth in time. So, in that sense, we don't need to be politically active or do anything. We can just chill out. It's all going to be resolved in the long arc of things. But, it doesn't, I'm not saying I advocate for that view, but I'm saying it's the extreme of on the one hand, it's all okay. On the other hand, I would say this kind of middle road of it is that death resembles in a lot of ways birth, and that it's a natural process that often enough goes well, and doesn't require a terrible amount of intervention besides just care and tending and tracking and some expertise. But there are also times where sometimes because of means of death, sometimes because of the unresolved stuff, sometimes the state of the soul, it certainly helps to have some spiritual practice. People who die really deeply believing on a soul level that they are alone and that everything ends after the death of the body will tend to find the continuity of consciousness to be kind of jarring and confusing. And so it depends on a lot of factors, but it doesn't always go well. And so the intervention, usually, traditionally, is a really effective funeral. And the rites, the death rites that follow that, the grieving and all that. If you want to make sure you don't become a ghost, live in a way that people miss you, so that you're actually loved and people care about you. That energy really helps after one's death to be carried along. If people are rejoicing at your death, well, probably not a good sign. And so if you don't transition to the next reality, typically there's three stages. Let's say there's some just died recently stage where the funeral rites happen. It's like you don't have to leave right away, but like get ready. It's time to move along. So you get to show up for your own funeral, but then come on now, move along. And then step two, hopefully you get there. You're not just hanging out in the house where you lived. Step two is like you've left, but you haven't quite arrived. You're in the barzakh, you're in the between state, you're in the next reality, but you're not necessarily in some deep unitive state of consciousness. You're in the bardos, you're between. And that doesn't have to last any set amount of time, but it's a time where the living often turn away from the dead. And it's like, give them, don't call on them, sometimes don't name them, but don't pull their attention here. They're having a process. They're neither here nor there. They've left, but they haven't arrived. And so the arrival, the third stage, is that they've been really welcomed in by the ancestors. They're like, oh, hey, welcome back, or you're here, we got you. And they're oriented, and they eventually get clearance to re-engage with the living. So maybe it's a dream, maybe it's a synchronicity that happens, maybe it follows the year, prescribed year of whatever it is. It's not always going to fit the pattern, but at some point, if it goes well, they're ready to engage again. That's a typical like progression, and I think the year gives time for it to play out. In reality, it doesn't always work that well. It doesn't automatically take care of it. And so the kind of ritual work that I'm often guiding is cleanup work from when the cultural practices of effectively ancestralizing the dead break down, when those things didn't work, or they haven't worked for generations because no one's been doing them. People think the funeral's only for the living. It's totally not. Or people don't know how to respond when the dead are like, I'm still suffering after 2 years, and they come through in repeated dreams. You'll be like, whoa, I just need a stiff drink to forget that dream. I'm like, no, your grandma's asking for help. You got to help her. Do some prayers, do something, you know? So the dead don't always make their way. And it's our responsibility in their time of vulnerability to not abandon them and to do whatever our traditions teach us to do or whatever practices are at our disposal to continue to love them and help them until they get settled. Otherwise, you can end up with a giant backlog of ancestral pain that can manifest as all manner of cultural trouble.
And there's chronic pain also in the body, right? Because the body is connected to those ancestral frequencies.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard because in a time like now, with the ongoing genocide in Gaza in particular, it's like when there's so much collective death that is happening so fast, so rapidly, right? There's people who are losing 50, 100 people, members of their family. There's, a different, like because I when I'm hearing you speak, I'm thinking about, okay, my ritual with my grandma when I lost my grandma, and that was a very like individual, personal relationship. It was very, very hard for me because I was very close with her, but I was very much focused on just tending to that relationship for like a year or two, but now it feels like we're just losing so many beings. So many Palestinians are being murdered, and some of them are in, close communities. So it's like, what is the wisdom you can offer around collective death and how we show up for that. And yeah, how do we be with this level of loss?
Well, large-scale war, which isn't new. I mean, look, my own ancestors were part of the several hundred thousand people killed by Roman colonization of Germanic peoples, which becomes an unmetabolized trauma among people that are often forcibly converted to Christianity, which becomes a metabolized trauma that's inflicted upon Jewish people throughout Europe for centuries and centuries. It's the precursor to the trauma of the pogroms and the Holocaust that become exported trauma onto Palestinian bodies. And so I'm thinking of Rasmah Menakem's framing of the kind of transmission or the displacing of one's trauma into other bodies when he's speaking of the kind of the blowing of the trauma of European colonialism into brown and black bodies through the Holocaust or African peoples, or not Holocaust, genocide, you know what I mean, enslavement, the Mafa. And so war in particular accelerates things in a way that makes it really difficult to keep up with the grieving, like you're saying. And so there's an urgent need to do this really careful, important tending. And so you get people like trying to gather up the body parts of their loved ones to bury them. And then the Israeli government bombing cemeteries. I'm like, well, the level of extreme transgression of what is sacred is, you can't overstate it. So what do you do? Well, I mean, the first thing you do spiritually is you participate in any ways that you can to physically stop those actions from happening. There's like the most spiritual thing that can be done is to stop the continuation of the genocide. Period. Everything else is kind of secondary to that. Stop the fresh killing. And yet there are limitations to how the ways that are available with that. I feel like I'm teaching about it as I can and trying to talk about it and like participate spiritually and add to that. Those things aren't irrelevant, but they're all secondary to physically stopping it. And like I can't, like there are things that are not within my reach to just have upheaval in my life with my family to, I don't even, what would I do? Like, what's the thing to do if I were to do that? So, but I think, and I say that as a precursor to anything so-called spiritual practice-wise. I don't say it's second in that it's not important, because it is important, but it's important that it never is framed as more primary than stopping the killing. That's first. So if it's a day where you've done everything within your reach to support that change and you have more time in your day, I think there are a lot of different ways to go with it. I think it has to be in accordance with your own destiny and your gifts. I don't want to suggest there's one right way to participate, but just on the level of spiritual practice, I'd say a couple of kinds of things include praying for those who are suffering. It matters. It's a participation in the larger energetic of things. Being willing to grieve and let the energy move through your system in a way that you're staying connected and not so flooded, but staying connected to divine sources while grieving. So it's a kind of non-abandonment on a soul level for those who are dying. I think that helping people, I would say Zionists in general, whether it's Jewish, Christian, I suppose other kinds of Zionists. I think most Zionists are probably Christian or Jewish. Helping Zionists to get unpossessed from the supremacy that they've internalized, because it's a kind of possession state, which is intoxicating in a way that's typically very unconscious. It's a tedious work that is not everybody's work, but for people who have the patience and that combination of like confrontation and empathy and engagement and debate and patience to help those who are potentially able to get unpossessed from that kind of predatory energy, that's sacred work. That's helpful in helping people to reclaim their humanity and have like exit counseling from that matrix of stuff. For some people, a minority of people, there's a kind of spiritual warfare, or like it's like spiritual war that can be undertaken. I am not personally electing to do that, even though I understand the principles of it, because I don't wish to jeopardize the other ways that I'm able to contribute. And that kind of spiritual activity exposes one to the very directly to the life-killing forces that are driving the genocide. And I don't know that I feel equipped to just wade on into that. I don't, I'm a little protective of my longevity. So I'm contributing in other ways. A last thing I'll say, and it's a big topic, it's an interesting question. I know I'm speaking at length about it, but I'll say that getting really healed with one's own ancestors is a big piece of what can contribute. It doesn't immediately shift everything, but it helps. I would say that especially anyone listening who has any European Christian ancestors, to oversimplify, the genocide we're seeing now is, if not entirely, like almost entirely, a consequence of European Christian and cultural supremacy that's been inflicted upon Jewish people for centuries. It's not an excuse for anything that's happening now, but the massive unmetabolized trauma of the Holocaust, as well as what preceded that, absolutely and obviously set the conditions for some Jewish settlers to be like given the car keys of European colonialism. It's like, here, go do this kind of evil in the world. We've enjoyed it. And the rehearsal, you want the blueprint for it, go have it. Have a go at the colonialism. And so that devil's bargain in a really horrible time in history for Jewish people was, well, that crossroads was created by Christian supremacy and European supremacy in general. And so I say that because even if any given listener doesn't feel like, what do I have to do with this? I'm not implicated in this. Well, if your ancestors are, that gives you a kind of connection to the larger mess that you can work with integrity, and helping your ancestors to be in a healed state and to have them backing whatever other tangible activism you're doing, that's useful. That's a way of entraining your spiritual practice and your activism. And it's good to break to combine those.
Yeah, definitely. Appreciate the multi-layered answer to that question. And one of the things that I appreciate about you is that you are a spiritual leader who is also political, who is, standing up against the genocide publicly, calling for a ceasefire. And one thing I wanted to talk about is that it's been really sad, I think, for me and for so many of us to see so many spiritual leaders that we have looked up to either be silent, or if they're not silent, spiritual leaders, trauma experts, therapists, healers, the way that they go about talking about this is very much like, oh, this is just all trauma. We all have trauma, and sometimes the trauma conversation can be very just flattening of the urgency of the political
Yeah.
movement and the reality of, like you said in the beginning, it's
I
like we
know.
must do what we can to stop this genocide, and just a way that sometimes a trauma conversation really takes away from the action.
I know. I could I have a lot of feels about this topic, so I can try to say a thing.
Yeah, we'd love to hear it.
The first thing I'll say is I'm not personally a fan of anything resembling, and I'm not saying you're saying this, of anything resembling call out culture, shaming people, making assumptions about people's path and all that. So I absolutely can think of people I know who are spiritual teachers who, for whatever reasons, and I don't know, it's not necessarily my place to judge them, they're not opting to be very vocal on social media, but they're privately like speaking about it, teaching about it in their own ways, donating thousands of dollars to Palestinian relief, and like caring about it, grappling with it, participating, calling their reps, attending protests, but they're just not choosing to blow it up on social media necessarily. I've chosen to kind of blow it up there, but so people can engage in lots of ways. Okay. But I think of someone like Brené Brown, for example. It's like, okay, like I've respected her work for some years, and her mom was dying. That's huge, you know, like who knows what's going on for her with that. But then she finally made a statement about it, and it was a mess. It was really an atrocious, hot mess of a statement. And I'm like, oh, Brené, like I'm disposed to see you in a favorable light. And your statement was a disaster. You probably didn't run it by like anyone, or if you did, you ran it by the wrong people. That was bad. I'm going to publicly
Yeah.
say that was bad. It was so bad. I'm sorry for you. I'm embarrassed for you. And but so when people do speak up, like welcome to speaking up. You got to work with the repercussion that comes from whatever you say. That's fair. That's how speaking up in leadership goes. But so that said, the fact that I'm not like I'm so cool, bad other spiritual teachers. I'm not saying that. It's been really surreal for me because I have my little niche, but I look around like and like it's maybe like December and I'm looking around. And I'm like, where are the other people? I don't understand. Like, there's a weird feeling of like my peer group has suddenly shifted. Where are the other adults in the room? I'm like, there's one. There's one. Oh, look, it's all the brown people. What else? Like, no surprise. And you would think that they're already attuned to oppressive dynamics and can read it from a mile away. And so it's felt kind of shocking in a way. I mean, intellectually not, like, okay, not surprising. Because as in the US, I've been tracking for some years, I'm like, of all the dynamics that would totally cause rupture, it's this one. People will, whether or not they understand anything, everyone would be like, I'm not racist. I'm not racist. Everyone will line up to like say the right thing, whether they have any depth of understanding about it. But this topic, it requires a little bit of nuance. Like on October 6th, there's not a lot of spiritual teachers who could tell you that Zionism and Judaism are different. There's not a lot of like basic knowledge of things. So in that way, there's a vulnerability to just, basing your information on whatever little bit is available to you and falling back on your limited expertise and be like, well, let me just say some shit now based on my limited understanding. So in that way, people's lack of knowledge of the world and their lack of understanding of both anti-Semitism and like anti-Muslim, anti-Arab sentiment, all that makes them ill-equipped to deal with the moment. So there's a lack of education for one. I don't know that it's like a lack of caring. There's people are like, oh, there's bad things happening, but I don't know about it, and I don't want to blow up my practice. Well, I've gotten some pushback from speaking out. So has pretty much everybody who's spoken out. Like, would you blow up your practice, like, to oppose racism if it offended some racists? I would hope so. I mean, what's your practice based on? It's not that mouthy Zionists on social media don't need love too. May they have that. But in this moment, historically, their position is unjust. It's not sound. And so, but yeah, I'll just add one other piece. I didn't necessarily expect it as like a life development, but I was stepped in with Islam in my early 20s for a couple years, and then my path led in another direction. And then a year and a half ago, coinciding roughly with our move to Spain, it'd been kind of brewing for a while, but I stepped back in and just started observing Salat. And I'm like, wow, I don't know where this is leading, but it's what I need to do. And so I've been practicing Muslim and for the last year and a half. And on just a personal level, it's been a impactful, but also like oddly encouraging. And like, I mean, emotional to talk about it. The level of, I guess faith is the word, but like undefeatable clarity among Gazans and Palestinian people is really, it's been inspiring. And it has, I mean, it's horrific that these are the conditions under which it manifests, but for me, I guess for me personally, in my role, it's like the fact that I also happen to be Muslim has helped me to have a bit more of a constructive, like, fuck it kind of attitude about speaking up, because my peer group is changing in a way. And it's like, oh, well, you don't oppose this. Well, I mean, what I'm doing might not be a match for you, and that's okay. You might need to like find a cozy, insulated white American trauma teacher who doesn't want to read the news to help you to feel good about yourself. That's not what I'm offering.
And I think you kind of nailed that in the last thing you said around sometimes trauma healing work is really just to make people feel good, and there's so much of that, especially where I'm at, Los Angeles, like, which is really about working with systems of capitalism, systems of colonization, all these systems that are so destructive and so harmful to our bodies and to the world. And I think that it's we need such a massive societal and collective shift to re-understand healing and spirituality in relationship to political work,
I know.
because ultimately it is the same thing, right? It's
It's
about
hard
the
for me sometimes to keep just doing the spiritual teacher job, because it feels it does and doesn't, but so there are moments where it feels secondary to what is happening in the world. But I know it's an important function, and we're not going to be able to be everything in all situations. So there's a need to be like, well, this is what I'm bringing. I'm going to bring it in a way that is unflinchingly honest about history and politics and oppression. And at the end of the day, I'm a ritualist. I'm like a priest. And that's, I just know that about myself. So I need to stay in my lane generally, but I'm going to inhabit it with a sword and an opinion and like my own way of being about it.
Yeah, definitely. No, and thank you so much for actually speaking up through social media and through your teachings. Like, I think it is really inspiring, and it also is just, showing that it is possible to be a spiritual teacher and be in, the healing trauma world and still take a very strong political stance in this moment. And I really hope, especially if there's people listening who are on the fence around how to integrate all that, like people really see more possibility for all those intersections.
It's a funny thing to say, but I've been thinking about it recently, is it doesn't get said that often. I'm speaking up also selfishly. I'm speaking up to stay whole. I'm speaking up as a kind of self-care on a soul level, because I don't know what else to do. Like, I've called my stubborn ass Zionist Republican senators in North Carolina enough times that they probably know my name, and I've donated to relief trucks sitting at the border blocked by Israeli settlers and American Israelis celebrating the starvation of Gazans. And I've boycotted big dumb corporations and all that. But and I'll keep speaking up and like historically informed and do the things I can do. And and speaking up is also my own, I don't want to say my way of personally processing my stuff, because I try not to use it in that way. That would be out of bounds. But it's when there is genocidal behavior or things like it, and I know it's happening in other places, in Sudan, Congo, and Myanmar, and in other places too. I'm just less directly karmically implicated in quite the same ways, because the United States is at least as responsible as Israel for this. And I'm less informed about those things, frankly. And so that's just me being honest. But when things of that magnitude happen, there's a breach spiritually in the world. There is a otherworldly evil or predatory forces walk the earth. And as a priest, I take offense to it. I'm like, I mean, there's the desecration of life in all the obvious ways. And then there's the way that I'm like, you are desecrating, you're breaking the rules. You who are allowing these forces through are jeopardizing life itself. You must be stopped. And so I take it very personally in that sense, or it's a, I feel protective of here. And so those are some of the motivations. But when I speak up, the point I wanted to make is that there's a selfish element too, that I'm just trying to keep myself whole, because it's a lot. It's a lot of trauma that is directly manifesting on Palestinian bodies and families and the land, and differently, and Israeli and Jewish peoples. And it is sending a message, a loud signal globally, that if the colonialist powers want to genocide you out of existence, they can, and no one will stop them. So everybody else, take note. It's 2024, and if the powers decide they're going to do that, they're going to do that. Nobody's going to stop them. So there's that really like trauma, like freshly traumatizing dynamic that activates all this historical old pain for people. It's like, wow, just in case I needed to be reminded that the world is not safe generally, got it. I got the memo.
Totally.
So all that, and I picked up our daughter from school today. She just ran at me, gave this big hug, and I was running around in circles, and it's like, goofing around. And so part of our work of staying whole is also to be full spectrum people who are able to laugh and play and be bored and joyful and, angry and all kinds of things if we can. I think that's good for the movement. It's good for long-term outcomes. It's important for the longer vision to not just, if you can avoid it, to not just wade into the waters and drown. There's plenty. There's plenty of that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I resonate with spirituality being about, right, protecting and tending and following the life force, right? And that is also, right, this very political work of like how do we actually protect life itself and learn from this life force. Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on the podcast. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to talk about? I know we didn't talk so much about Andalusia and your move
I
there.
like it here. I'll say that I'm, yeah, I'll say that I'm, I never could have imagined this would be the historical moment we're in when we made the move, but for our family, at least, it's been really good to get out of the US. And I'm I love so many people there and the land, and there's so many brilliant people, and the systems and the government and the overarching energy and all that is it's really heavy. It's really hard to be with. And I feel not in an optimistic moment about the trajectory there. But I feel good about Spain overall. Spain's been pretty, like, almost on the level of Ireland good in terms of European good
That's true.
relative to Palestine. So that's encouraging. It's just not amazing, but it's encouraging. And no, I love it here. We're happy here. It's part of what I realized that I didn't think through before is it has the longest presence of Islam in the earth ancestrally of anywhere in Europe, specifically Granada, which was the last place to fall to the Christians, longer than Bosnia or Southeastern Europe and the Ottomans. It's like at least a dedicated 700 years here.
It's pretty
So I.
amazing. And like I did my Sephardic Jewish mystical retreat in Granada this past summer,
Right.
and there's so much depth in that land.
Right.
And I think that there's so much in the Andalusian region in general that's like actually wanting to express, right, around the especially the intersection of like Judaism and Islam and its offering to the world, and the ways that, especially in the Western kind of Christian view, those religions have been very distorted.
Yeah, I don't know if you realized it when you were here, but the this part, like Granada province, has the oldest documented history of homogeneous in Europe,
Oh,
as
wow.
when they recently found a child's tooth near Ocre, which is in the eastern part of Granada province. It's 1.3 million years old. So,
Wow.
and the ice ages didn't come this far south. And so it's continuous inhabitation for at least that long. I was with the
Wow.
kids last week in some caves just north of Granada, La Cueva de las Ventanas, and they had only been inhabited for 20,000 continuous years. The nearby Neanderthal caves had like 35,000-40,000 year inhabitation, and so there's a lot of not just cross-cultural but cross-species. Or cross-subspecies exchange here with the overlap in Neanderthals and sapiens. So it's a real intersectional dynamic place. So I feel grateful to be here. And otherwise, people, if they're moved, can see what me and the team are up to, the ancestral medicine. And I'll share just one tiny thing about that that I feel proud about is that the practitioner network. The work of ancestral healing is now offered in over 20 languages,
Wow.
which I feel heartened about. And there's a ton of opportunity for low income sessions if people need that. So we're committed to things being accessible internationally, economically, culturally. So trying to put a dent in the larger backlog of tending that's needed.
That's beautiful. Wow, thank you for sharing. And people can find all of that just on ancestralmedicine.org.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay,
So.
lovely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your perspectives and your process. It's been really beautiful to just hear more about how you're holding everything in this moment. And I appreciate your work so much. I, did my own ancestral medicine trainings and definitely like learned a lot through that modality. So I appreciate
Great.
all that you do.
Thanks, Adar. Yeah.
Thank you.
Same.